Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 27th, 2015, and welcome to episode 110 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, that kind of thing. I'm your host from the Left Coast, Earl Evans, and with me is a large collection today of our regular irregulars. I'm going to start with a guy that I haven't talked to in a while, sadly. I missed him, but now he's back. Hello, Carrington.
Are you going to talk to me sadly? Hello, Carrington.
Sadly, I have to talk to Carrington, but it's my job.
Yes. I'm back. I'm nationwide.
Nice. You're multimedia and interactive. Beautiful. So let's just jump around the globe, shall we? Let's jump over to Sweden for Mr. Jack Nutting. Jack, how do you do, sir?
Hey, Earl. I'm doing pretty good.
Good.
I've been out barbecuing today on the grill, which is probably the last time for this year because it felt like snow in the air.
Snow already?
No, it won't. It won't actually be any snow from this, but it had this sort of little nip. Can you say that? Nip in the air?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little crispness.
I'll bleep it out.
Yes.
Everything's dirty if you bleep it out. You can make any of a sound.
Bleep. Well, fine. If we're going to talk to the bleeping bleeper, let's go over to Paul. Paul, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing quite well. It is also just turned... it seems like winter here, too. No snow, but it's cold. All of a sudden, had a fair amount of time. As I'm kind of reorganizing things in my office, I'm testing things. And so I've actually started up a bunch of computers recently, which is kind of fun.
You can warm yourself by the little fires they start.
That's right.
Yeah, any magic smoke?
Nope, not yet.
Yay! That's good. All right, and continuing our globetrotting... We go to Mr. Michael Mulhern, the wonder from down under.
Greetings, everybody.
How you doing?
Pretty good. It's spring here. It's beautiful in Sydney this time of year. It's mid-20s. It's just excellent. And I should be dragging the barbecue probably out next weekend to get it going. So what you guys put away, we're starting to take out and play.
Excellent. The circle of life. Yeah, you folks down there, you got the opposite polarity on the seasons. I think that's fun. Yeah, that's fun stuff.
Globes. How do they work?
Yeah.
That's the ball.
Coriolis.
It's the ball.
As a Canadian, I would like to chime in to say, I hate winter. I hate everything about it.
Well, you live in Toronto.
We get winter. We get
just
winter.
Slightly colder than the surface of the moon, I'd say, in winter. But what are you going to do, right? I tell you what you're going to do. You're going to win the lottery. We're all going to win the lottery.
Excellent.
For the host topic, let's pretend that all of a sudden money is no object. However, you do have one constraint. To your retro computing collection, you can add one. That's just one retro computer, but it can be any one. Which one do you add and why? I'm going to go in a random order. I'm going to start with Michael. Michael, what computer, if money is no object, do you add to your collection?
Oh, no object. I was pondering that one. I would have to go for one of those lovely early mainframes over at the National Museum of Computing over in the UK. Probably the Witch or Colossus, so that I could have my own little piece of groundbreaking history and that way leave the field open to everyone else. But yeah, I think I'd go for some ancient big iron.
Beautiful choice. It's a beautiful choice. Carrington, top that.
I would go for little iron. That'll show him. I am very fortunate in that I have most computers that I would have considered. And so it's lucky that we're not just saying pick one, because that's the difficulty with the collection I have at the moment. That I have, I guess, five or six retro computers, which is four or five too many. I would be happiest if I could just settle on one. So we look to add to my collection. The difficulty there is just thinking, oh my gosh, it's more stuff to own. But there is a particular computer that is on the shortlist that I want and would own if I could ever come across one that didn't have either major problems with it, either in not being functional or not being aesthetically pleasing, because that matters to me, or not being just ridiculously expensive. But now that I'm going to be a lottery winner, I cannot care about such things, and I can pick up the one vintage Macintosh I don't own that I wish I did. I currently have an SE30, which I adore. I have an LC475, which I also adore because I have an Apple IIe card in it, so double duty. Beautiful computers. But when I was a kid, when I was younger, I also owned another computer that I then got rid of foolishly that I would love to own again. And it's probably my favorite of the mid-90s Macintoshes, both in the way it runs, the operating system range it can run, and its capabilities, its form factor, its everything. I adore it. And it's the 840 AV. I completely love this thing. I owned one back in the day. I then upgraded it to a Power Mac. I think it was the 8100 via a board swap. The only time I've ever done that, because it never really works out financially as a smart move. But I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. It's probably the only tower computer that I've ever loved the form factor for. But I loved it then. I love it now. I miss it. And if I was adding one computer and money was no object, it would be a Macintosh 840 AV.
Was that one of the Quadras?
It was indeed. It was the fastest of the Quadra. Of all the Quadras, it was had the most quads. As it ran at
more quads for your
big
buck.
Old 40 megahertz versus the 25 and 33 that most of the other ones did. And the nice thing is that AV on it. There were two AV computers of the Quadra era, and it meant it had video in and out, not just monitor out, but via RCA plugs. So you could do video capture, you could have like a little TV window open, and this all just was included in the computer as it came from Apple. Now, obviously, back in the day, we're dealing with a 40 megahertz 040 computer here, so not a lot of speed. It's not like you could do a really high definition video, but you could open a small, you know, 240 by 160 or maybe 320 by 240 at like 10 or 15 frames a second video, but you could do it and with sound, and you could capture it, and it was speedy. And if you want a computer to do the pre-Power Macintosh like games or like basically run vintage Mac things in full color with lots of grunt and basically be able to do anything, the 840 AV is the top of the heap in my opinion.
Excellent. Well, cool. We got big iron. We got small iron. Paul, maybe you have to go with middle iron.
More irons in the fire.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a tough question because, you know, of course, the first kind of thing I thought about was, well, maybe, you know, get one of these like war games computers like an MSI or something. Actually, that's probably what I'll get. Never mind. But the thing is that, I mean, there's not a lot you can do on it, but we can sort of kit it out, right? We can get all the
blinged and as you know, whatever kind of accessories you want for it. Money is no object, remember.
Well, I think then, yeah, I think I would. Just partly because I liked the look of the computer in War Games. You have to like the look of that computer.
Mm. Oh, but, the MSI is beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's probably where I will go. And I think without the lottery, I am unlikely to have one of these. So this seems like a good place to spend the winnings.
Okay, perfect. Jack, I'm not sure what size of iron that leaves you with.
Well, it's going to be a bit middle-sized. Bigger sized iron than what I'm used to, though. I'm going to go with the Xerox Alto. This was the machine that was
I was so close to choosing that.
Beautiful choice.
This is the machine that inspired, obviously, the Macintosh and pretty much every other sort of modern GUI we have today. ran an early version of Smalltalk. I've never seen one of these in operation. I've just seen pictures and maybe a video or two, and I would love to have one of these to play with. And I guess I chose this because of all the computers that were released, you know, in the 80s and forward when I started using things. The only ones I sort of care about, like actually playing with today, are mostly the Atari ones, which I already have some of that stuff. Like, and I don't really care about that much about using any of the older things beyond, apart from that. But it would be fun to go back even further a step to play with one of these things for a while. Just I've never tried it out. And it, you know, it has this sort of mythical quality because it, you know, it inspired Steve Jobs to create the Lisa and then the Macintosh and all this stuff. So it would be a cool thing to try out, I think.
They are really neat. Have you seen one up close?
No, I've never had one in front of me at all. I've just seen pictures and stuff.
Ah, because they have one at the Living Computer Museum up in Seattle. It's an interesting device. Yeah, I agree. Excellent choice. Well, so for me, I'm a little torn on my choice. I was pretty close to going with a PDP 1170 because that's the computer system that I used when I was in college and always dreamed of having one of those big PDP units. And, you know, I won the lottery. I could have raised floor and the whole thing. But I'm not going with that. Do you guys know of the CompuColor 2 computer?
Very little.
We've heard about talked about it.
Very interesting computer. One of the first.
It's got that weird keyboard, right?
It does.
It's itself very colorful.
The keyboard is very colorful as well. Yeah, I saw one when I was in high school. They're nearly, not completely, but nearly unobtainium these days. And to find one that would be completely working and with all the fixings would be extremely expensive. But I won the lottery, so now I can have that. And actually, there was some work done on an emulator and a website and all that for the CompuColor 2 not too long ago. I think it was on floppy days that some of the background and history of the CompuColor actually came out on the Floppy Days podcast. But I loved that computer from back in the day. So that would be my dream computer should I suddenly become crazy, filthy, absorbently rich.
It's funny, it seems that I'm the real non-collector among us because you guys are talking about these big things and crazy expensive stuff, and I just think in terms of, yeah, I'd like an 840 AV, but if I got one, I'd get rid of my SE30 and my LC475. Like, I think
because they
really
take up too much space.
Well, kind of, yeah. Like, I'm the sort of guy who dreams of just, you know, chucking it all and living in an Airstream. Like, I like to live small and light, and I don't know. Like, it to me, the only computers I'd ever really consider having, even with money being no object, is something I'd want to use a lot and actually use like all the time. So if I like an Insight or something is gorgeous and amazing, but I want to visit one and not own one. Like to me, it would be like having ballast in my life, like just this big thing I've got to dust. I just wouldn't use enough. So for me, if I won the lottery, the last thing I would want is any of your choices. It's so I wouldn't even take one for free. Like it's just to be like, well, I mean, I guess I would because then I would sell it. But yeah, like for me, it's just I have too many computers as it is, and I love the industrial design of certain models, but I really, in a perfect world, would only have one retro computer and I would give it all my love instead of being the polyamorous retro computer guy that I am, I guess.
It totally, totally makes sense to live in a lightweight and minimalistic fashion. I wish I lived that way sometimes, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm going that direction or not.
Well, how more minimalist could you get with the fun of packing up Colossus and shipping it all the way to the other side of the world and putting it back together and...
That would, yes, that definitely qualifies.
I guess if you only had one computer and it was Colossus from the movie, like it was the voice of Colossus.
I'm talking about Colossus as in to break the
saying
the
Bletchley
sure,
Colossus.
Right, yes. No, but I'm thinking I want
I know,
the voice of World Control.
Wants the Forbin Project Colossus.
And then you don't have to have anything but like a little display that just prints out stuff and speaks to you.
Of course, it sticks you in a room and monitors your life. But
well, then you're minimal, right? Because it controls everything.
There you go. Life is easy. Mm. All right. Well, I'm moving on. I'm going to listener feedback. We got a couple things here from Tony. He sent us an interesting article on adding instructions to the 6502 with a little hardware hack. So what this does, it's just a little hack on the opcodes that in a way, intercept what's coming to the 6502 and change slightly the logic of what happens when those opcodes come in. So it is almost like hacking the microcode of the 6502. It's more like front-end interception and then a little bit of clever duping the hardware into doing what you want. So good article. I would read it. And if you want to read it, you can, because we'll link to it. Or maybe we won't. We'll just fool you. No, I think we will. We will, Paul, right?
Yes, we will.
Tony also sent a link to an interesting compilation of information about the Ferrante Atlas computers. I know nothing about these, had not heard about these until we got that link, so I much appreciate the information. It says they're developed in 1959, launched in 1962, and much of the information here stemmed from a 50th anniversary celebration in 2012. So these are not only interesting computers, but they're old computers, as computers go. Older even than the ones that we normally talk about. So if you're interested in either of those links, rcrpodcast.com, you can find them there.
Yeah, I'd never heard of the Ferrari as well.
Had not?
Nope.
The Ferrari? Or not the Ferrante either.
No, I'm calling it the Ferrari. But no, it was all jokes aside, this was totally news to me. Like, and so I went to that article, then jumped over and read the stuff about the Mark One story. And this is neat. Again, wouldn't want to own one, but I had never, ever, ever come across this before. I don't think it's ever even been mentioned around me.
Yeah, so thanks very much, Tony. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Now we're to the items of interest. We hope you're interested in them. Well, Carrington's got one, so I maybe you'll still be interested in it.
You will be, because I'm fascinating, and I'm going to talk about it with enthusiasm.
Tell it.
And I'm going to shock everybody, because it's not an Apple thing. It's an Atari thing. Oh, my goodness. But it's super cool. So there's this game that I was not aware of, because I wasn't really an Atari guy, but a game called Claim Jumper by Gary Chang for Atari 800 and 400. And a fellow that you may have heard of named Kevin Savetz, I guess it's pronounced, he has scanned and uploaded, with Mr. Chang's permission, the original development notebook that Chang used and to take all his notes and design this game. So it's all in graph paper, as one would want to use, but it's super, super, super crazy cool to rifle through. And I don't know Atari development at all, but if you've ever done any sort of assembler development, you'll see, oh, look, here's a list of opcodes, and you can see the flow control. He does little, like, as one would, especially back then, like, here's my, pick a page and do a flow chart and say, how will the logic work, and then scratch it out on the next page, do a revised one. And there'll be pages that have the sprites all sort of doodled in, and then beside it, a calculation of like the math involved to get them to display. And it's really neat to see not just the final work, but to see the sort of the stages that go through it. And it's incredibly detailed, like much better notes than I've ever taken, which is the reason why back in the day, Mr. Chang was publishing software and I was a kid playing software. And this is the difference between us. But it's amazing and really, really interesting. So if you're interested in vintage game development on any platform, or in particular, the Atari 800 games or development, I highly recommend checking it out. So I'm very glad that this Mr. Savetsa scanned it and made it available, because super cool. I just was delighted reading through this thing.
Nice. Well, those crazy antic guys with their crazy antics and preservation and interviews and stuff like that, they create interesting content faster than I can consume it. And I'm in awe of all of this work. So
that's great.
Thank you.
One of the things about it, we've talked in an earlier episode ages and ages ago, that one of the first, in fact, I think maybe the first printer I ever owned was for the TRS. It was either my Model 1 or the Coco, but it was a Tandy thing. And it was a tiny, teeny, weensy little printer that used little pens to write. And the paper, though, was maybe 10 centimeters wide. It was like it was almost like a cash register printer.
It was that
but
roll
a little
paper,
wider.
Right?
Exactly. It was a roll yeah. paper to write on it. So what I like is in this notebook, there's a whole bunch of printouts where you'd print out the listing of the program and then make notes on it or scratch things out. And those printouts are also in like that tiny little paper and then it's stapled in or taped in. So he was working with one of those teeny printers too. So I use that as an excuse that held me back. Gary or Gray Chang did not. Again, the difference between us in the 80s.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very
cool. The notebook blew my mind. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. And I'm not sure if I am remembering this correctly, but I think there's a sort of a separate story about Claim Jumper 2. Like, I think it was released under some other name or Jack, are you familiar with the game?
I'm not sure if it was released under a different name. I think he had a couple different versions of like the same sort of idea. I remember because they interviewed him on Antic, obviously. And I think this was either like the precursor to something else or this was kind of something that came later after something else. I have played this after they interviewed him. I never played it back in the day. And it's a fun little game. And I think, I don't remember the exact story, but there was something like there was kind of like a multitude of games that this guy made that were all sort of thematically similar in some ways. So, but he's made all of the things sort of like open on his website. He has a lot of screenshots, maybe some videos, and like he writes about making these things and stuff. It's pretty cool. I have not looked at this development notebook though. I will definitely check it out now based on Carrington's glowing.
Exactly. It said enthusiasm. See, I was going to bring the enthusiasm.
You did it, man.
You brought it.
You were not lying.
It has been brought in.
And since, Jack, you've got the talking stick at the moment, you've also got an Atari-themed news item here.
I do. I do have some Atari news. This is not about old classic Atari. This is about modern zombie Atari. They have released a new, or they're in the process of releasing a new LGBT-themed game for iOS, only in Canada, for starters. And it is a Pride Fest game, and the idea is that you somehow create a pride parade in your little city. So it's kind of an isometric classic Sim City view of a little city, and you can sort of set up a parade and set up things to happen to sort of bring joy and fun to your city. And I've not played this because I'm not in Canada, and I have no idea what it's like. Like, I have not seen a video. I've just seen some screenshots. There was the article that we're going to link to, it quotes someone who reviewed it last year, who I guess they had, I don't know if they saw it last year, but they at least were remarking on the news of it, saying that basically they saw this as being rather exploitative or opportunistic rather than being sort of inclusive. So it remains to be seen whether or not this is something that is trying to appeal to the LGBT community in sort of an inclusive and open way, or just sort of try and sort of suck money out of people who they've identified as being underrepresented. But anyway, it's interesting. And I think, you know, I don't think that I've seen a lot of games that are really sort of tailored towards or built around things that are interesting to the LGBT community, or for that matter, any kind of minority. It's interesting to sort of have them make a stab at this.
Huh. I wonder how that's going to turn out.
Canada's awesome. I just like to point out.
I completely agree.
It's cold.
That hadn't been mentioned in a while. So I may hate winter, but I dig Canada.
Nice.
Well, maybe that's why they went with Canada first.
Well, yeah. Canada first. That's a slogan.
I've heard you say that once or twice.
Ironically, I am unapologetically Canadian. Get your head around that.
I'm just going to move on to the next news article. Which is me. So that's a good thing too. But it's from Tony again. Thank you, Tony. Lots of news from Tony this time. And this particular one, very cool also. A long time ago, we talked about something called the 1802 membership card, which was kind of like the Cosmac 1802 kit, but stuffed into the form factor of an Altoids tin. Well, the maker of that has taken it one step further and has made a Z80 single board computer project that you can also stuff into your Minty Fresh Altoids tin. And boy, I'm really tempted to buy one of these and actually build it. And it looks like it would be less work, perhaps not as fulfilling, but less work than something like the PyDP or whatever. But then again, we won't know that until Jack and Michael actually build their PyDP. But if you're interested in the Z80, which I'm always interested in, oh, and sorry to my international folks, the Z80.
Thank you.
Right.
Then you will want to take a look at this particular link, which will be up in the show notes, and you can see, yes, indeed, can you stuff a Z80 into an Altoids tin and make it work? You can.
Went back to Z so quickly.
Well, yeah, Zed, it's just such a stretch.
It's just so crazy talking English.
It is. I speak American.
Well, Z is so much shorter.
What? Okay, fine, Paul. Hey, my fellow American isn't hanging with me here on this. Why don't you talk about Sean's garage giveaway and the GoFundMe to help keep this wondrous tradition alive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this will only take a moment to mention, but and you might have heard of Kansas Fest if you've heard some prior episodes. There's this event that happens every year, but anyway, so every year at Kansas Fest, for going back for quite some time, Sean Fahey has transported a bunch of sort of extra Apple equipment that he's got, and that actually also that other people have donated it's kind of like an effort to keep it in the community. And so in general, the stuff is free for the taking, though they have taken donations at the time. But the problem is, of course, that it's not actually free to transport it there and that sort of thing. So just as kind of an experiment, Kansas, I don't know if this is the Kansas Fest committee, but the Kansas Fest organization has put together a GoFundMe campaign in order to kind of help defray the costs of putting this together. So this is relatively specific to this one event, but it's kind of worth, I think it's worth mentioning, making it publicly known, because apart from the cost of sort of transporting things, this is all, this is all being basically just given to whoever comes to the event. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure that people heard about this if it's sort of something that is in their either sphere of interest, or anyone who has directly benefited from this before, for example, or intends to benefit from it in the future. It's a nice way to kind of support it.
I think everyone who has gone to Kansas Fest would say that they have benefited from it. It is crazy. It is, yep, just bonk. You show up and it's like this massive, massive display of mostly Apple-related things just sort of there. Please take what you'd like. It's just, it's bonkers. It's like eBay went free for the day or something. It's just crazy. And once you've been to Kansas Fest enough, I've been there enough now that I love it and I love watching it happen. But the last two times I've gone, I've taken literally nothing, because you have everything. If you go to Kansas Fest enough, the garage giveaway will mean that in your hands eventually will be all the Apple II stuff you want, because you'll just get it. It's just bonkers, and it's amazing to see the people that go the first time and the way their eyes will light up and go, so I can just take this Apple IIe. Like, yep, here, have a monitor too and have some cards. And it's just amazing. I love it. I was happy to support it. I think it's a phenomenal event, and the fact that they do it every year, the time involved, and the hard costs of transportation and storage and stuff, I really, really appreciate it.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a very worthwhile activity to support. Michael, so you've got a news story here about something with an I and then a whole bunch of E's.
And then some more numbers after it. Yes, people sometimes forget that all this wonderful technology that we use today had to start somewhere. So 25 years ago, a working group started to work on networking. So IEEE 802.11. So that little group got together, started standardizing things. Part of it is got going by NCR, because people were having issues with drilling holes in floors when they were remodeling and moving stuff around and hooking up their cash registers. So in 1985, the Federal Communications Commission voted to leave some large blocks of radio spectrum unlicensed so that people could basically go in and do things and leave it available for others. So that's all where our favorite Wi-Fi started. So we'll provide the link. And there's a good story on NCR and how they approached it. Then, of course, there's all the other lead-ons from this working group and the different Wi-Fi technology and everything that developed. And now you've basically got this as probably one of the most pervasive networking structures that are there. You know, nearly everyone has a Wi-Fi network in their house now because, again, they don't have to run the cables through the walls. Now, there are problems with it as far as range and penetrating masonry and things like that, but all in all, most of us have a Wi-Fi network that's easily implementable straight out of the box so that we can hook our laptops and our phones and every other device under the sun that needs a little bit of networking magic. And folks, it all started 25 years ago.
Wow. I didn't realize that it had been baking for so long. That is really interesting. I got to go read this article. Thank you, Michael.
Wi-Fi's a fad.
Yeah. Pretty soon we'll wire everything
I think
up
Token
again.
Ring is going to make a big comeback in 2016. You heard it here first, folks.
Excellent.
Pass the cookie.
Yeah, having done Token Ring, I'm glad that it didn't.
We're all glad that it did.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, my goodness.
I used to actually teach courses in it. Oh, shudder.
Shudders, right. One thing I really like about this article is it relates to the last thing we were talking about, because there's this photo of the participants in the IE 80211 working group.
Yeah,
and you'd swear this is a photo from Kansas Fest. I look at it and go, was this a year I just didn't go? They're all in Hawaiian shirts. And a lot of the people look kind of like regular Kansas Fest attendees. I look at him like, well, that's Carl, and I swear that's Sheppy. We look at it, it's like that's Michael at the back. Like,
well, Kansas Fest has been going for 25 years, right? Maybe they invented Wi-Fi.
It totally looks like a K-Fest group photo, yeah. Completely. I was like, oh my goodness.
They're our people.
Plus, it's fun to say IE, because it's like, IE, Wi-Fi.
Oh, Carrington, why don't you just continue your tirade?
I will. I'm going to talk about ladies. I'm going to talk about the ladies. So there's an article.
Not just ladies, but superheroines.
Superheroines, exactly. So this is an article related to a book. So Walter Isaacson, who I know as the guy who did the Steve Jobs book that nobody liked, but he has what this article claims is the fastest selling history of computing book ever, and it's The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. Now, this article is discussing that book and about how that book is a little more inclusive of the female pioneers of computing than a lot of other histories are, and that it also takes the stance that some others don't, that it's not these mad individual geniuses that do things, but usually the great steps are taken by groups or people working together, and it's in a lot of that. And sometimes one person will sort of rise up and get credit or get acknowledged as being the woman or the man who did a thing, but a lot of times it's actually a bunch of people did it. It's either a general zeitgeist or a few people working together. But in particular, this is a really interesting article because it features one of my personal computer heroes. And it's not the first one they talk about, which is Ada Lovelace. Did great things. I argue she was a bit loony and gets more credit than she deserved. That is a thing that is not a popular opinion, but there you go. However, it talks about Grace Hopper. And anytime Grace Hopper gets mentioned, I want to talk about it because Grace Hopper is like my total hero. Steve Wozniak was my most recent computing hero, sort of invented the stuff that changed my life and blah, blah, blah. And it was just amazing to meet him. But when I got into older computing and I got into the history of computing and computing developments, the one name that bubbled up that just was mind-blowingly amazing and just did things that I appreciate and still can't get my head around how awesome she was Grace Hopper. So crazy cool, and is unfortunately listed as one of the forgotten women by Isaacson. Grace Hopper, if you do know her, you would know her basically as the person who invented the compiler, which is just a crazy bonkers step, because lots of people want to argue about where computing starts, like what was the first computer and what would we consider to be a computer. I think a lot of arguments can be made that Babbage's the analytical engine was really the first general purpose computer, but never actually got made by Babbage, so it's sort of the proof of the computer or what have you. But there's lots of things that came before that that were adding machines, and lots of things that came after it that were technically computers. But it's Grace Hopper and the invention of the compiler that makes a computer what I consider is actually a computer. And it was such a big leap from a world in which compilers didn't exist and the idea of a compiler didn't exist. And then she sort of invents it and makes it, and nobody believes her. There she's like, and I was like, no, computers are just like basically adding machines or whatever. She's like, no, you could do this with them. And it's such a leap. And to be able to see that in a world that that doesn't exist just blows my mind. So she's also a big force behind COBOL, and she's big for, like, in UNIVAC and like all these other things, and did and just did the most amazing things. Died in the 90s. I never got to meet her, but I'm like a fanboy of Grace Hopper. So this is an interesting article about what appears to be an interesting book. I would recommend reading the article because it does bring up some, you know, women in computing, and people forget that they were, especially early on, such a major force in computing. But in particular, Grace Hopper, and I'm a super fanboy, and I love articles that mention her, so that's why I wanted to link to it.
Very cool, very cool. And, you know, I was really excited for this documentary, although it seems like that it's a little fuzzy what the status of it is at the moment. But, of course, there was one of those crowd-funded efforts to create a documentary called Born with Curiosity regarding the life of Grace Hopper. And I'd really like to see that come out and would be very excited to purchase it. And I, like I say, I don't know exactly what's going on with it at the moment. The Twitter account and the Indiegogo are a little vague on where things are at the moment. But I certainly hope they complete that, because I was very excited to see it and to have other people see it and learn about her life. There's a great interview, by the way, with Grace Hopper on the David Letterman show. And if you guys haven't seen that, maybe we'll try and dig up a link to it. But such a fascinating and bright person. I mean, just, you know, staggering. And this interview, she had actually retired from active military service and was there just talking about some of the things from her life. And it's definitely worth a watch if you've never seen that before. Have you seen that one, Carrington?
I have indeed. I seek out everything about her.
Gotcha.
Like I said, total fanboy. Cool. Just, she made these leaps that her brain, just her crazy, amazing brain, is just so impressive. And as a computer programmer and a fan of programming, and a fan of what one can do with what we mean today as a computer, or what a computer is to us now versus what a computer was originally. It's her that sort of took us into that, took that leap to general purpose computers are not just math things. They are this thing. Oh my gosh. I could do a whole podcast just about her. I'm such a fan.
Very, very cool. All right. Well, we'll have a couple links up there for you guys. And here's a couple more links that are not as interesting as the ones that Carrington just talked about, but kind of dovetail with what I was talking about before with the Z80 in a can. If you want to have a 6502, a 6809, or a Z80, and you want to have that in hardware, one way that you can do that is with FPGA. Sorry about the bleeping in the background, guys. That's I got some chats coming.
We often have to bleep Earl.
Yes.
It's just, you know.
I don't blame you. FPGA systems are kind of an interesting middle ground for me between having the actual old computer and doing a complete emulation in software with code and logic and RAM. FPGA, of course, being programmable logic gates that you can make your own little swingy gates that you want in hardware. I think they call them FPGA cores, right? When you come up with a program set for an FPGA. And then it actually acts like the chip that you told it to act like. Now, this could be a chip completely of your own design, or it could be a re-implementation of something that already exists, like a Z80 or a 6502, something like that. So we will have a couple links here for you. A couple different people have taken a crack at how you build your own 6502 based around one of these FPGA development boards. The first link we'll have is a complete rundown of how you do this with a Cyclone 2 FPGA board. The second link is someone who took that project and moved it forward a little bit to a Cyclone 4, a little bit later model. I just find this stuff fascinating. I think playing around with programmable logic gates is about the closest you could come to ever making your own CPU or making your own computer chip. And it's neat stuff. So if you want to go play around with that, do it. And there are actually some FPGA development systems that are, I think, a really reasonably priced, right? Like the DE Nano and that. Don't one of you guys have one of those? Crickets.
Not me.
I thought one of you guys had it. Well, anyway, no, you don't. But you should, because they're fun. And that's all I got to say about that. Jack, what is a retro VGS?
Well, this actually ties into what you were just talking about. The retro VGS is a new thing that we have talked about a little bit before. It's an upcoming video game cartridge-based video game system. They now have a campaign on Indiegogo, and the idea is that it's not going to be able to compete with the Xbox One or the PlayStation 4 in terms of the graphics
quality
of the games.
Not with that attitude.
Not really. A step up here. No, but so it's got an ARM CPU. It's got some 3D hardware. It seems like I'm looking at the hardware description, and it's maybe roughly on par with, say, an iPhone 5, an iPhone 4S, something like that. So I mean, you can have some decent quality games. But the nice thing is they're actually making a cartridge-based system. The hardware design is directly lifted from the Atari Jaguar, the same molds and everything. But of course, it's a modern machine that will have USB controllers, as well as classic Atari controllers if you want. It's going to have HDMI, a variety of things. And one of the interesting things is that the hardware, besides having a CPU and a GPU, it has an FPGA. And one of the things that they're saying is that they have a certain goal that they need to reach. They say it's $1.9 million, which is pretty big. If they reach beyond that, they have some stretch goals that will enable them to have a bigger FPGA. I guess, you know, essentially more gates. And that will enable you to, in hardware, do more stuff. So in an FPGA, you could emulate not just the CPU, but say all the chips around some retro system. So the idea being that it would be a pretty straightforward way, in some sense, to take existing retro titles and deliver them in cartridge form for a modern piece of hardware. So they have some options here. They have some options for funding this. You can just give them $10. You can give them $300 to get an early bird black retro VGS, and they have other more advanced sums of money for, you can get the gold retro VGS or the elite backer edition retro VGS for more and more money. But one option I like is they actually have an option for $25. You get the retro VGS USB controller, which you can use, of course, with anything that takes a USB controller. So it's you kind of get something, which could be cool, and then you can sort of hedge your bet and see if the device is actually worth buying later when it comes out. But I don't know. I think it's an interesting concept. I feel like their monetary goal is pretty high. So far, looking at it right now, they have raised $63,000 of their almost $2 million goal. So they're 3% of the way, 8 days in, and there are 38 days left. So unless this thing starts to really take off, I think it's going to be have a hard time making this happen. But it seems pretty interesting. Now, the one thing that kind of is question mark for me is they don't publish anything about what their APIs are like, or how you're actually going to deal with this as a software developer. They say that they've been sort of reaching out to particular software developers to try and get them to port their retro titles to this, and they've had hundreds of people contacting them. They've had, you know, tried to establish some sort of dialogue, but it seems like in this day and age, if you're going to launch a platform like this, the smart thing is to also make the API aspect of it wide open so that you can get as many people as possible interested in porting their software to this. So I don't know where they're going with that, but it's a cool project anyway, and everyone should take a look at this if you're at all interested in having a new hardware platform for playing old games on.
One thing they have in their favor is being Indiegogo rather than some of the other funding platform. Other funding platforms are available. They'll get their money regardless of what gets contributed. So if they don't make their full $1.95 million goal, but they did for some reason get like $1.8 million, they would at least get that, which I think would probably help the project go ahead. That said, I will be remarkably shocked if this gets even anywhere near $1 million. I think it's awesome, and I think as a $300 US price point, it's a non-starter. It'll never sell, and because they won't sell, it'll never get any games developed for it. Total chicken and egg thing. This needed to be well under $100. There's too many you know, retro systems and little indie things and Raspberry Pi based systems and stuff for playing this sort of game that you can pick up for $35. That's what they're competing against. So they're going $300 against $25 and $30 systems, and I think they're going to get destroyed. And it's so neat, and I think it's a real shame. I completely agree, though. I'm glad you pointed out the fun part of this is it's a nice looking controller. I think it's a very fun looking controller, and I think it's a controller that looks like it's absolutely worth $25. It's a dual thumbstick, multi controller, like USB. I'm like, I would buy that for $25. So that seems like a no brainer. You can support this, get that. I'm just hoping they actually make the things. Like, who knows if they only get 100,000 in development, will they actually make the controllers? I don't know. But I would buy that controller for $25, so I do think it's worth contributing there, but I don't think the system's ever going to take off. And I'm sad to have that opinion, though.
Well, and in an indie world, you've got things like the Ouya that you're competing against, if I pronounce that correctly, the Ouya console, because that's $99 with the console.
And was also essentially a non-starter.
Yes, in a sense, it was. But, you know, there's lots of indie games that are out there for it, though. Thousands. I don't know what the quality is. I know a couple of people who have them. So it was this idea that we don't want to be locked into something like a PlayStation or an Xbox where you have to jump through 100 hoops to be able to publish your thing. But you've got a good point, Carrington, on the Raspberry Pi, that if you want an inexpensive platform to go doing some indie development on it, and with the little arcade kind of enclosures in that people have made for the Raspi, I don't know how you get much more cost-effective or open.
Yeah, no, the fun here, so like Jack was saying, the fun is that this is cartridge-based. I mean, that's the thing that separates this from everything else. I love the idea of a new cartridge-based system. That'd be fantastic. I would dig that very much. I just don't think it's going to exist. And I think I really would like one, and I wouldn't drop $300 on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Paul, so there's more letters here. I don't know what they mean. What's a JKL museum?
Okay, well, I have a bummer of a story for you.
Bring us down, Paul.
Okay, so this isn't actually, you know, it's not retro computing, but it's kind of in the same universe. So the JKL museum is the American Museum of Telephony, and it's the name is the creation of the owner, John K. LaRue, and they also happen to be the initials that are just above the number 5 on most telephones. But so it seems to be a really amazing thing. I'm trying to figure out how to say this, but see, basically the museum had, and I'm now using the past tense because the bummer part of this is that September 10th this year, it burned down, and it's so horrible. So I just, you know, like, it's newsworthy, I'm so sympathetic. There was lots of really kind of like interesting prototypes, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. So they have a website. It's still there. And they have, you know, lots of pictures of the stuff they had, and, you know, some sort of sad photos of what it looks like now. They are intending to try to bring it back in some way. But of course, you know, it was full of old prototypes, and it's a horrible, horrible loss. But I mean, it's also the kind of thing that it's hard to know how to protect against that. You know, you can't have an offsite backup. So at any rate, but definitely just out of respect for the place even, but also because it's really interesting. Go take a look at the website. They have there are a number of kind of like online exhibits and things like that that, you know, you can sort of look at things, look at the pictures of the prototypes and various things that they have there. So, but anyway, yeah. So it's, where is it? It's in California, somewhere.
They also mentioned, yeah, Paul, that they're a 501c3, and if you make donations to them, if this is something that is interesting to you, something that you would like to see restored at some level, the donations are tax deductible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're also calling out for new items or replacement items. But yeah, it's very sad when that happens, because, you know, a lot of us know that, you know, there are, you know, people with interesting collectible items in their at home in their personal collections, and you know, you're afraid for those things being thrown out when that person passes on, and so you collect all this wonderful stuff at museums, and unfortunately there are risks inherent in that. And I saw this come through and this article, and it's a very sad thing, and I hope they can get it off the ground again and start collecting other pieces of the early telephony and get going again. It'd be great.
Which is so hard to do. I find it much more difficult to redo something than do it the first time. It's so disheartening to try. I mean, looking at these photos, it was beautiful. I can't believe this stuff. I would have loved to have visited this. Holy cow, this was gorgeous. And it's so sad to see the after photos, which is just a fiery wreck. Wow, it'd be so tough emotionally to say, okay, well, let's try to gather back up the things we already had. Like, oh, that'd be hard to build again.
That's the problem with physical items, that you can't put a backup in the Internet Archive.
Right, that's true.
Jason Scott's going to come and go, well, actually, I have something to announce. In case you know, he's going to solve that problem eventually.
If you're ever out this way in Seattle, there is also a telephony museum as well as the Living Computer Museum. I've been told that it's quite an interesting visit. There's also at least one, if not more, YouTube videos up there about it. So
I will be out in the Portland area in February, I think. So there.
Oh, very nice. Well, Michael, I'm going to let you close this out here. I looked at this link. I have mixed feelings about it. I can kind of tell from your entry in the notes that you do as well. So why don't you tell us about the Mega 65?
Okay, well, the Mega 65 is an open 8-bit computer. So they're saying it's a C65-like computer, hardware designs, and the software are going to be a LGPL license, and that you can build it yourself or you can get it from them if this all goes ahead. But the pictures are nice. The idea, yeah, it's interesting. But do we really need a brand new modern 8-bit computer, even though it does have, you know, all the modern day interfaces, SD card support, Ethernet, extended memory? I'm a bit torn on this one as well. So I personally lean more towards getting my real old 8-bit computers and shoehorning them into the modern world with modern add-ons or enhanced software. Not quite sure how successful this is going to be. Some of the information I was looking for is a bit light on as far as how they're going to be doing all of this. I'm just wondering, so do we really need a new 8-bit computer? It's sort of like the video game system we were just talking about, but I think that's just got a little something, a different approach with the cartridge support. But I suppose it really comes down to Now, will there be a market for it? And I suppose the advantage of this one is they're saying that we're going to publish out all the schematics and build instructions, and probably that's for the case and everything as well. So, you know, what do you think?
Well, speaking as a Commodore enthusiast, I would say I'm very lukewarm on this. I think that the Commodore community really wishes that the Commodore 65 had been realized and not just a prototype that died when Commodore folded up. However, I think that the time for an 8-bit computer had come and gone. I think the time is still, you can't go back to the past and resurrect something like this. I think the interest would be mostly nostalgia, because if you want to do a computer kit, or if you want, on the other hand, a modern day retro computer that's already built for you, there are several options that we talk about all the time on this podcast. So I'm not sure that this gives any kind of advantage, other than I really like the industrial design of it. I always loved the look of the Commodore 65, as unobtainium as they are. And so having a computer in a case that looks like that would be kind of fun. But aside from that, I don't see a huge advantage.
So you don't think that this is something that might give you, let's say, to coin a phrase, old school computing, modern day fun?
I'm just saying there are many options to do that.
Well, I want to say we actually talked about this in episode 101. Some of us were there. The thing that I'm looking at the website again now, and the website now in late September looks exactly the same as it looked back in May. Like, I just wonder if this project is even actually still going forward. Like, it's just hard to know. Has anyone seen any sort of actual new news about this, or are we looking at something that is kind of a husk of something that an idea someone had that is not really happening anymore? That's what I'm starting to wonder.
I vote husk.
I don't know. Tough to tell.
With anything Commodore related.
Easy killer.
Always husk.
All right.
I think we'll just let that one lie.
Yeah. I think so. Although I think I'll probably pop back to it every now and then just to see if there are any updates and if things move forward with it. But at the moment, a word from our sponsor.
Taking a computer along with you can create a few problems. Unless it's the new Epson HX20 notebook computer. It does what most computers do without the power cord. With a built-in screen and printer, you can do real computing and word processing anywhere at about half the cost. The Epson HX20. At computer stores now.
And we're back. And I get to talk about the host gift idea for this episode. And my gift idea, what I think everyone should run out and get me, is the black and white keyboard box. This is kind of like a memory box or a little small office supplies box or something of that nature, but it is made entirely of repurposed keys. So reduce, reuse, recycle. Here are some keys that have been recycled, you know, I'm hoping cleaned up a little bit, and then popped together to make a rectangular box of keyboard goodness. And you can have it for $23.99. I don't know how good it is because it's not yet rated, but if you want to look at it, you can find it at the link we'll have at retroplanet.com. What do you guys think about this keyboard box?
That is a weird looking thing. It's cool, but it's a weird looking thing.
I'm not sure how to touch it. Like, I feel like the keys suggest, you know, you should be putting your fingers in certain spots, but they're
to
everywhere.
To open it, you should have to type in a code for it to open up.
It's weird. Whenever I open this box, my TiVo goes crazy.
Yeah, this is a very strange, I mean, good choice, because this is definitely different than anything we've chosen before. This is bizarre.
Thank you. I love living on the edge. So let's talk about some more stuff that we could buy. Let's talk about eBay. Let's buy eBay. What do you guys think?
Just buy it. Excellent.
Let's just buy the whole thing. Give me one of each. Carrington, you start. You have, oh, it's something Apple. That's weird.
What a shocker.
Go ahead.
A couple of Apple things. And the first is something where I thought I had picked this before. And you know what? Maybe I have, but whatever. Something I definitely looked at previously on eBay, but I'm picking it this time. And it's a set of covers for the Apple IIc. There's an Apple IIc and an Apple IIc Plus cover. I think they're the same form factor, so I think either cover would work on either. They're still in their boxes, and what I like, and it's $20, and what I like is it harkens back to a time that I remember vividly when computers would get covers put on them when you weren't using them. Like when you come up to a computer, it would have a cover on it at work, and that goes back to the old typewriter days. You know, you don't want stuff falling into your typewriter because that was, you know, from the time of all the smoking and stuff. So and it just that carried over into early computing, and it's something that's lost. I don't know of any office I would walk into now after hours that would have covers over all their computers, but it definitely was a thing at the beginning of the home computer revolution, and I kind of miss it. And weirdly, of all the computers I have, which we opened with me saying I kind of have too many, even with being a handful, the Atari 800, which I still love, I have a cover for that and not a cover for any of the Apple stuff. So that's what I'm picking for my pick. It's a set of new covers for the 2C or 2C Plus. So if you have one of those, you can pick this up. There's multiple ones available, and it's just $20 for a pair of them. And I'm also picking as a small secondary thing, there's a boxed version of Blazing Paddles, which was the very strangely named drawing program for the Apple II. I would always get it confused with the similarly named pinball game. So I would see Blazing Paddles and assume it's a pinball game. It's not a pinball game. It's disappointed, just a drawing program. And that disappointed me many times as a kid when I would launch it. But what I like about this is it's a fully boxed version. It's a buy it now at only $28, which is a very reasonable price for fully boxed complete software from the period. So that's neat. And also it is a piece of software that I encountered many times as a kid. I know tons of people have had it, and this is the first time I've ever seen the box because this thing was pirated like crazy. I was like, oh, is that what it came in? And that's always a fun experience. So if you are aware of Blazing Paddles, as probably most Apple II users would be, but you've never seen the package, which again, probably most Apple II users didn't, this is a chance to look at the box that it actually came in, and it's kind of cool. And it's, awesome. Like I said, only $28 for complete boxed software. Not sealed, but still pretty good and in very good condition.
Very cool.
It's interesting that the box has images of some sort of like digital pad, and what looks like an Atari joystick, and it looks kind of like a Mac mouse.
Totally.
And it's all for the Apple II. This is incredible. The Apple II.
Yep, that mouse has a glowing button on it. I don't know. It's a very strange... Yeah. But yeah, Blazing Paddles, not a pinball game. Someday I will get that straight.
Yeah, back to your covers. There's been quite a few times I've walked into other computer sites and you sort of sit down to demonstrate something and you look at the keyboard and you kind of wish, oh, you wish that it had a cover on it.
Right, so do you never clean your keyboards? Yeah.
What hides under those keys?
Lunch.
Ooh, you don't want to know. No. I'd popped open the PET 2001, took out the keyboard, completely disassembled it to clean it, and it is a bit grungy in there.
Yeah, I've had to deconstruct quite a few keyboards to so that they'd be workable, and it was surprising how much they worked with what they had in them.
My Commodore 128 has a keyboard cover on it.
And so
it
should.
Keep that baby clean. Mm-hmm. So now it's my turn. I'm going to talk about a TI-99/4 peripheral expansion system. These things aren't unobtainium. You can find them, but often they look a bit beat up. I thought that this particular one on eBay was in really nice condition. Now, it doesn't have any of the cards other than, I think, the little card that connects it up to the computer itself, the flex cable interface. But aside from that, none of the other controller cards that could go in this expansion chassis. But if you look at the pictures that are here on the eBay auction, it looks really clean on the inside and out. This fellow's in good shape. Mm-hmm. And I thought the price was reasonable, too. Mm. It's a buy it now for $85 US, and to me, only $35 shipping from Garland, Texas. So overall, if you're a TI-99 enthusiast and you've been looking for one of these, you will have to go out and find some of the expansion cards, if you would want those also. I'm assuming you would, if you got the expansion system. But not a bad price, wouldn't you guys say?
No, fair. And you're right. Great condition. Like if I was a TI guy, I would pick this up in a heartbeat. Yeah, nice.
And shipping to Australia is actually quite reasonable. It's only $75 to get it down here. So
$47 to Canada. Yeah, good shipping. Great look inside and out. You're right, Earl. Like great looking. You couldn't ask for a nicer bit of kit. Like, wow, nice find.
So that's mine. And Michael, you've got some RAM for the VIC-20?
Yes, it's selectable. So one card, and you've got 3, 8, 16, 24, or 30K selectable for your VIC-20. So it's a nice little piece of kit to expand your machine up. It has some good detail here in the auction, including a small program for doing a bit of a memory test just to display what's available. Quite reasonably priced, $25. And even just down here to Australia, only an extra $7.50 postage, so probably pretty cheap for you guys up at your end of the world.
I don't understand this thing.
You don't understand
it? Well, it's okay. Why would you select to have less RAM?
I suppose it's more to do with compatibility. It's compatibility with different programs. But yeah, okay. I would normally go, 32, click, I'll set
right,
it
totally.
To that.
I'm like, why is this? I mean, cool, but it seems totally ridiculous. Like, why would anybody set this to less? What's up with you Commodore people? See,
well,
this just feeds right into my bias.
I can tell you one thing. Now, in terms of the 8, 16, 24, not a huge reason to switch those around. But from 3 to those other RAM sizes would actually cause certain parts of memory like the video RAM to be relocated. So Michael's right, it's for compatibility reasons. The difference, though, between 16 and 24, why would you do that? That I don't know. I don't know why you would want to do that.
Mm.
But
it's probably cheaper than
it's cool.
Disabling the dip switch.
Yeah.
I have a theory this is for developers to be able to test their software on different configurations of VIC-20s without having to actually swap cards.
That's a good idea.
All right, so that army of Commodore VIC-20 developers will finally have so much time saved.
Don't get the denial forum angry at us. There's a lot of people over there cranking out code for the VIC-20.
At least they're not trying to load it.
And they're
it
using
still.
This to test for different devices with different amounts of RAM.
What Jack said.
Right. I like it.
But, so I am kind of tempted to get one of these.
Oh, God. Paul, you have a problem.
Well, one thing I don't quite understand. So does this go in the cartridge slot? So does it?
It does.
So does it occupy the only slot you have? So you can have 32K but can't put anything in it?
But what a lot of people would do is get one of the slot extenders for the VIC-20. That's what I had back in the day.
Yes, yes. Now that you've mentioned that, I think we had this conversation before.
I would jump on one of these in a heartbeat. I wish that my VIC-20 was working, actually. I think the VIC chip has gone bye-bye. How can you tell when it's working?
You're making comments.
It's the red LED, Carrington.
See.
That's how you know. You and I got to have a talk.
I think Carrington was sort of like heading off into loading time.
And Michael, you had another thing here, an Epson CX-20. I've actually got one of these. Yep. They are fun.
Yep, this is...
I'm looking at one right now. What a bunch of fun we are.
Is it singing to you? Because you can put it in auto-answer mode.
This is a beautiful auction, Michael. Please talk about it.
Sorry, I'm trying not to cough.
Wow, this is in the box. And
it
everything.
Is.
This is nice.
Let me just and as I coughed, I actually closed the tab. Let me try this again.
Is that how your computer works?
It's cough controlled.
He's only got 3K of memory, so
yeah. Flip the dip switch. You need some more memory in there.
No, the dip's on the keyboard. Okay, let's try this again. Yeah, it's a new in the box. Or looks new-ish in the box, Epson CX-20 Portable Acoustic Coupler. I don't think you'll be able to dial in and connect to anything, but as far as acoustic couplers go, this is a nice piece of equipment. And again, it's quite reasonably priced. Well, the starting bid is, so if you're interested in this, you might be able to pick it up for the opening bid of $30. But I don't think there'll be too much competition from your RCR podcast hosts. It seems most of us have already got one.
Yeah, although mine is not in anywhere close the condition that this is. Mine is pretty badly yellowed.
Someone should buy this and send it to the JKL Museum, because they should have this kind of thing.
They could
right?
use one. Yes, indeed. Telephony modems, relays.
I think one thing that's nice about this auction is that they have actually opened up the back and are showing you that the battery is not
dead.
You know, a
exploded.
Nasty white mess.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's healthy. I mean, I actually didn't read the
but it's not a
I can
gooey acid.
I mean, it's yeah. right.
I can almost bet you that it isn't, and I can tell you that if you go to Batteries Plus, they'll make you a new one and reasonably priced, because I've had that done with a battery pack that matches this one 100%.
Excellent.
Yeah, as to working or not, in the comments he says, I honestly don't know if it works. But
yeah,
I would assume
no
it does because it's packed like new. Well,
right.
Yeah, we all know about how packed like new really works.
Right. This reminds me when I was the only time I obviously, like all of us, I used acoustic couplers many times in my youth, but I only ever had one portable one, and it was by Neuer Technology. They made a lot of Macintosh peripherals, and I had one that was a portable coupler, and it had little Velcro straps, and it was just really the two little cups, and you would strap it to a phone and hold them tight with Velcro. And so you could be, you know, a road warrior with your power book and your strap on acoustic coupler. I was so cool.
That is amazing.
Let's have a little talk about that cool part.
I'm redefining the word part of my coolness.
The TRS-80 Model 100, and its, you know, successors, also had a similar kind of like separated acoustic modem. You know, the cups are they didn't strap on with Velcro. I don't know exactly how you got them to stay on.
Yeah,
but where could one
get a Model 100 nowadays?
See
5 minutes from now.
All right, so what do we got here, Jack? When the moon is in the seventh house, it's time for your auction.
Yes, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, the Mattel Aquarius. This is a computer that I barely remember. It came out in 1983, and Mattel was sort of riding high on their Intellivision success, which was pretty successful, and they said, hey, let's make a computer. And my understanding was they actually engaged the same company that had developed the Intellivision, which was not Mattel, but some third party, to make this computer, and so they did. And this thing, I've never actually seen one, I've never held one in my hands or seen it in a shop in front of me, but I remember that at the time I was shopping around for my very first computer, which turned out to be an Atari 400. I remember looking at this because I think it was in the Sears catalog or something. And I was like, interesting. And so I can't really attest to whether this thing is any good or not. I know it runs on a Z80, and there was very little software for it. And this actual device here is not really sort of complete. It does not contain controllers. There was some sort of expansion kit that contained controllers. This does not have that. It's just the device. The person selling it did plug it into a TV, not with the original RF cable, with a Nintendo RF cable, and they include a photo of that, which just frankly looks like hell. But you can see that there is text on the screen. It is working and showing you a Microsoft Basic prompt. The other problem is that whoever took the photos of this thing, they don't know how to focus their camera. So like,
no,
all
it's the same guy who photographs Bigfoot all the time. It's like,
yeah, I don't believe the Aquarius really exists.
Yeah, I'm not. This may just be a mock-up, all of it. I don't know. So, but on the other hand, it is only $15, and considering that I found in the links below, someone else is selling a Mattel Aquarius complete box only that they want $40 for.
Yeah, no,
so this thing,
it's
which
a
is
bonkers
in a box,
good price. Yeah, no, it's a $15 for. Come on, this is a great price.
Yeah, it's dirt cheap. The auction expires less than 2 days from when we're recording this right now, but there are zero bids, so it may appear again, even if our show is not out before then. Anyway, interesting little thing. Has anyone ever played with one of these things?
Nope. I had it in television, though, so I got that going for me.
I have not I haven't used it for much, but I do have one of these. And I wanted to mention the... So it's true, not a whole lot of software came out for it, but there's a very cool kind of like multi-cart that you can get. It's a like a homebrew, you know, modern thing called the Aquera cart. And I'll make sure that there's a link here. It's sold through eBay, but I think this is the person who made it that sells them through eBay. You can get the Aquera cart, which has essentially all of the cartridges that were ever made, plus a few homebrew things. On a menu selectable thing that you can put in.
Nice.
So,
and it's $66 for your $15 computer.
Right. But I mean, So there's actually a set of things that you can get with the Aquarius. I forget how much memory it comes with initially. Not a lot though. They sold, I think it was 8 and 16K memory expansion cartridges. And there's also an expander too, which, you know, does the same thing like that we were talking about with the VIC-20, you can put a memory cartridge in and then a game cartridge. But they had a themed tape recorder, and there's a modem and a printer. I have all of these boxes up on a shelf above me. they look nice, but I think the system itself was kind of a flop.
So this 32K RAM memory upgrade that you've linked to, is that switchable down to 3K? Because that's a new thing that I want in my life.
That's right. Sadly, I think
not.
Maybe you can write to the developer.
We're not going to buy it then.
Nope.
Yeah, I think there is a small, like a small little loyal following of Aquarius users.
There is, and I saw one in a thrift shop for $10 one time, and I'm still kicking myself that I didn't get it. For that price.
With anything that old, any following has to be loyal. Like, who's like, yeah. No, I never really liked it, and yet I follow the news. Like, so there are only loyal followers for any of this stuff anymore.
So earlier we were joking about buying eBay. I'm scared one day Paul is just going to do it. Paul, why don't you go ahead with your auctions?
Okay, so yeah, I'll go through these things relatively quickly, I think. But one thing that kind of jumped out at me, somebody, I don't know why they thought this was a neat idea, but it is kind of a neat idea. Someone is auctioning up a collection. It's a "your account has been suspended" notice that they got from CompuServe.
It's fantastic.
It's angst.
This is one of my favorites of all the auction items you've ever picked. I think this may be my personal favorite. I love this thing.
So, yeah, 12/12/28 was outstanding, and so the account has been canceled. You can write back with your Visa written in there to get yourself reactivated.
But the best is the balance, $12.28.
Yeah. Okay, so another sort of whimsical little thing is a floppy disk traveling case. I thought this was kind of cool. It's like a little fake leather pouch that says "traveling case for the floppies," and it sounds like that's supposed to refer to something, but I don't know what. But it it's big enough to sort of like zip some floppies into, and then on the back it has an ASCII chart. So I thought that was pretty cool. It is.
Well, that's handy when you're reading your floppies.
Yep, trying to reconstruct the bits that have fallen off.
I love it. Honestly, if this this doesn't ship to Canada, and if it did, I would have probably bid on this, because I would like to take some stuff down to Kansas Fest, and this would totally be the traveling case for my floppies.
It's quite cool. Yeah, so this is a $2 start bid. For me, it's only like under $3 shipping, so it's at least not starting at a very expensive point. There was a we mentioned the Model 100 due to the acoustic coupler before, and there's I pretty much like every third episode here I link to a Model 100 auction. This one is kind of notable just because there are boxes for everything. There's the computer, the Model 100 24K computer in its box. There's a portable disk drive, manuals for that. There's I think one of the more common books for the Model 100, the TRS-80 Model 100 portable computer, a complete step-by-step learner's manual, some cassettes, and actually there's a huge number of actual Radio Shack software binders. There's something I don't even know what, 10 of them. So it's really complete. It has some ROMs in it that are not super common. So if you want to sort of see what kind of thing you can get for the Model 100. This is actually a pretty good auction to look at. It starts at $100, so it's not, they're not kidding around, but it's probably worth it. You can buy it now for $400, and that might be kidding around. Okay, there were two just pretty keyboards I'll link to. So I found, you know, one is a nice Data General Dasher D2, which has some nice blue keys, and a Raytheon Data Systems terminal keyboard that has some nice sort of almost Atari themed keys.
I would happily use either of these.
Yeah. Yeah, one of these days I want to get one of those cherry keyboards of, you know, various flavors. I probably like the ones with the clicky sound.
Oh, cherry flavor, but, presumably.
But replace it completely with custom keycaps and some kind of color theme like this.
And your
like
own that, language. General one.
Yeah, well, no, Klingon, of course.
Yeah, that's it. But both of those keyboards sort of jumped out at me. You know, like I have no use for them except they just look nice. So there is a Apple Color Plotter that is listed on eBay. It is pretty uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if people have heard of this before, but Apple did make a color plotter, you know, that has the four pens and would sort of do, you know, very fine drafting kind of work. It looks a lot like an ImageWriter 1, and they really do not come up very often. So this is not cheap. It's starting at $250. It does look like it ships internationally. So I don't know. I'm not sure that's a good deal exactly, but if you're curious to see what one looks like, here is one.
I think it's super cool. Looks like it's, I never knew this existed. You're right. It looks, I would have thought, like, from first glance, it's just an ImageWriter, and just like I wouldn't have noticed that it's sort of missing the middle bit. And it's really neat. I never knew that this printer existed. I've never seen one, so I think it is pretty rare. It's never come up on eBay that I've noticed.
Well, I did notice it once.
Did you buy it?
And I did. Anyway, yes.
I think this is, you're crying out for an intervention here, Paul.
That's right. Okay, the last thing I want to mention is not, it's a sort of a different category of thing, but there's a project that sort of lets you plug in an SD card to a SCSI device. So this is good for sort of those early Macs, you know, sort of like, I don't know, early 90s kind of time, late 80s, when SCSI was being used and IDE wasn't yet. So this is good for like an SE30 or something. It's basically a little adapter board that lets you, you know, basically plug in an SD card to a SCSI device. This is, the project is SCSI to SD, and I'm pretty sure that there were cards. I mean, it's not a new project. There have been cards available from Australia for quite a long time, but someone in North America has kind of banded together with the creator of it and done a fairly large run of these boards that are being sold out of the U.S. So this, it's actually super cheap, it seems to me. The SCSI 2 SD card with a 256 megabyte SD micro SD card is $65 each, and then, you know, standard shipping. So
yeah, there used to be some SCSI CF adapters, and they were considerably more expensive, you know, in the up to the couple of $100 sometimes. But $65 for this SD SCSI adapter is looking quite good.
This is the exact one that I have in my SE30, and it works great. I'm super happy with it. I'm pretty sure I spent more than $65 on it too. So I would vouch for this as being an item that works terrific. It's compatible with a ton of different computers, but I think only specific ones. So you'd want to make sure yours is on the list. Like, I think it works with the SE30, but doesn't work with the SE, for instance, weirdly. So there's some weird limitations. So I'll dig up the list of compatibility, and we'll stick that in the show notes as well, because I checked against it. But it does work on a lot of old, like, Commodore ones, a lot of old Apples, a lot of Amiga and Atari things, and like there's a wide range of computers it will work with, and it worked seamlessly and perfectly in my SE30.
Yeah, I am intending to put one in a next slab. I think it will also work in that. So, but yeah, anything that uses this kind of SCSI interface, and they're difficult. You know, otherwise these are. It's always been kind of an expensive proposition to try to get that to a CF card, because it's basically converting SCSI to IDE. Mm. So,
and that's one of the big points of failure in a lot of these old computers. Like in my SE30, I was worried about the caps, so I redid that. You're worried about the monitor dying and worried about the floppy and the hard drive. So this removes one of those things. And, you know, from the outside, you can't even tell. It's just, it works a little bit quicker, I find, than the SCSI drive that was in it originally. But it's more that it's super easy to switch between volumes, and it's crazily reliable. So I was very happy to do
and,
the upgrade.
And very quiet.
And very quiet. Yes.
Yeah.
I swapped the fan
some
as
of the
well.
Hard drives in those SE30s just spun up like an airplane engine.
Yeah, the fan and the hard drive were both super noisy, and I have changed them both.
Excellent picks, Paul. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the end of buying eBay. And now we're into the closing discussions for our pentagonal table. And I'm going to start in the order that we have them here. Carrington, what do you have to close us out?
Steve Wozniak is running for mayor. So,
how could you not vote for him?
Well, the reason I'm bringing this up is it freaked me out and basically stopped my heart and made me reexamine my entire life because of a typo in this article.
That must have been some
so
typo.
Steve Wozniak, he's running for Evansville mayor. I mean, again, like, I love Steve Wozniak, but what do I care? He's running for mayor for a place I'm not voting. But it
has a great name, though.
It opens with,
there.
Here's the thing, though. Very beginning of this article, Steve Wozniak, a 42-year-old entrepreneur, said he plans to run for mayor. And I was like, hold on. Woz is 42. I'm thinking, so when I was a kid, he, what? So
invented this, the Apple II when he was
right.
six.
So this is, of course, a different Steve Wozniak, because moving
there
to Australia,
can only
he's probably
be one.
Right. Exactly. But this article freaked me out. I was like, he's younger than I am. So as a kid, when I'm using the Apple II, he was, how young was he when he made these things? I thought, I've totally misunderstood, like, the age at which he did these things. I have accomplished nothing in my life. And so I freaked out when I read this. I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea I wasted my youth. Turns out I did waste my youth, but it has nothing to do with this particular fellow named Steve Wozniak. But this article did indeed stop my heart. So I thought we would link to it. And I hope that Steve Wozniak wins.
I don't really have anything I can follow that up with. Hey, you guys, what was the name of that enigmatic chess player from the 70s, the U.S. champion, the guy who always disappears and then resurfaces? And you guys know who
Bobby
I mean?
Bobby Fischer?
Bobby Fischer, yeah. He wrote a book that I was reading when I was seven, Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess. And the book begins with kind of a biography of Bobby Fischer. It talks about how he started at chess when he was five. So I'm a seven-year-old reading this, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm already behind. I had the same reaction you did with the Steve Wozniak thing, Carrington.
It hits you harder when you're in your 40s.
Yeah, at seven, I bounce back. So I, heck with it. I'll go into computers. Good thing I didn't see this article.
Right. It was one thing to go to Kansas Fest and see that Quinn had basically done it herself and said, like, here's my computer from scratch. I'm like, okay. But to think, wait, Woz did it when he was, what, seven or something? Like, it just floored me. So I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to reevaluate everything.
Oh, that's hilarious. So I'll close out by saying I've been having fun playing with this microcontroller Wi-Fi board called an ESP8266. If you haven't heard of one of these and you're into electronics, you should check it out, because you can get the simpler version of the board for just a little bit over $2 shipped. And it has Wi-Fi capability. You can run a little scripting interpreter on it if you load that firmware. It's got, I think, 128 kilobytes of program space and 64K of RAM, and a couple of general purpose I/O lines, Wi-Fi connectivity for a little over $2, which is why it's just taking the Internet of Things world by storm. And I want to see what I can do to hook these up to some of my favorite retro computers, but also I'm just having a lot of fun playing around with it. And the other thing is, The Phoenix has risen. Chicken Lips Radio, after a two-year hiatus, I heard you guys mention on the last go-round, came back, and I'm really excited. My co-host Todd is a great guy, and yes, we will publish the next episode before 2017. In fact, we're actually just about ready to get together and record on that. So, lots of fun. And passing it over to Jack, it looks like he has zip nil nada to talk about. Do you want to elaborate on that, Jack?
Nope.
Okay. Then over to Michael. Michael, what have you got going?
Well, last episode I basically said that all the components of my top secret project had arrived, and it's progressing well, and the proof of concept, it all worked, so I'm happy with the code and everything that I've assembled, and now it's a case of getting it all together in a package. And what it is I'm doing an auxiliary graphics interface for retro computers.
Ooh, fun. That's nice.
So a little something coming on. So I want to get it all finished. Then I'll just put it up on my blog. It's basically so that other people can just download the code and just go shopping for a few bits and pieces if they don't already have it in their collection. So looking at as a cheap solution to connect an extra auxiliary graphics mode to our retro computers.
Wonderful idea.
Oh, nice.
Excellent.
And Paul, as you so often do, land this plane, baby.
Well, let's see. So what have I been doing? As I mentioned, I've been kind of going through and kind of testing lots of the stuff in my office. I've mentioned, I think, the last two episodes running, or at least recently, these 3COM Audrey boxes. Yes, I remember Carrington thinking they were ugly. So I now have four of them.
Are they multiplying, or are you actually...
Four Carringtons?
Oh, four Carringtons. No.
And now we will fight Highlander style.
They, in fact, actually... So they have a little CF card slot in them, and it is possible they have in their firmware a way to restore from CF card, so it's possible to flash a better, you know, operating system onto them than the locked-in one that they originally start with. So I succeeded in doing that with one of them. And one of the problems is that these things, they have kind of like a iconic little stylus that pokes out of the top. You know, it's a little clear, what do you call it, acrylic stylus. And there's actually a little LED at the bottom of the place where at the bottom of the well that it sits in, so that when you get email or something, it blinks and it lights up the whole stylus and it looks very cool. Everybody's lost their styluses. So I had, you know, I have all these Audreys, no styluses. But I was happy to discover, just on a whim, that checking on Amazon, they still sell them. So I now have some styluses on their way.
So how many have you ordered? You obviously haven't ordered just four.
I will have four coming.
Oh, no. Yeah. I thought you would have been pre-ordering to sort of like then get matching orders.
Just in case I lose one. Yeah, right.
Very stylish. Actually, so
they come in, I'm only going to get one more because they came in five colors. So I have four of the colors, and I'm missing the sort of bluish one.
Got to catch them all.
That's right. It's a clever, you know, very long game marketing strategy for people who collect, you know, the vintage version of your product. Make them in several colors.
Like the IMAX.
Right, exactly. But otherwise, yeah, no, I mean, I started up my Lisa 2. It works. I actually was able to boot it from a floppy EMU without a working floppy drive. So it was booting off a SD card. So that's pretty cool. I've gotten a couple of Wi-Fi enabled SD cards that I want to try to see if I can sort of like beam things into the Lisa from afar. It'll be pretty cool if that works. But anyway, yeah, just sort of experimenting. That's about it. I anticipate doing more experimenting.
Very fun. Sounds like fun is being had by all. Well, except for Jack, who yeah. Didn't have anything to say.
No fun over here.
And that's it. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. That's a URL pronounced Earl. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. And we tweet some things sometimes. Thank you, Ken. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we always mention we're a member of the Throwback Network. So whenever you don't like us, you can just throw us back. That is at throwbacknetwork.net. Please write a review on iTunes, please. Please write a review. Actually, reviews on iTunes help other like-minded people find us. So if you write a review, the other three people who might be interested will come over and listen to the podcast, and that would be cool. We love you guys, and until next time,
Retro-compute!
It won't actually be any snow from this, but it had this sort of little... Can you say that? In the air?